Checklists, I think, are something that I've had the kind of honor, I guess, of having my eyes opened up to in recent months working at Pythian. We've really created a culture around our checklists. And I think that what's really interesting is that if you ask most people, everyone will very much say, yes, 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 checklists do make things better. And checklists do help us not to forget things and make mistakes. But oh my God, no, I don't need to use a checklist. I'm gonna kind of not do a lot of talking about what a checklist is and how to build a checklist. I'm gonna touch on that. I'm gonna touch on areas of how we think and how habits are kind of created and broken. But they're gonna be very high level. What I'm gonna focus on a lot more is on how very often checklists are presented to us in a way that really sets them up for failure. And the very long and arduous journey towards acceptance that when checklists are presented to us in that way that we often embark on and sometimes never reach. So again, to start off, hi, my name is Chris. And, ooh, the power. And I've been a systems administrator since the mid-90s, and I've been around the block a few times. I've had the kind of the privilege of watching our industry kind of invent and reinvent what it is to be a systems administrator a few times over. And as part of that, I've also had the view of some of our greatest successes and also some of our greatest failures. Well, with that introduction aside, let's get to it. Checklist, no! So, believe it or not, I was that guy. I was that arrogant SOB, that bastard operator from hell, if you will, who was smart, knew he was smart, and was in no way the person who needed to use checklists. So if I can kind of come around and change, I think anybody can. But there's a significant number of challenges that our good friend the checklist has up against itself when it comes to culture and acceptance. And the road is often long and fraught with peril to get to that stage of acceptance. But Chris, why do we even need checklists? I'm so glad you asked. We need checklists because today we're more dependent on our data than we've ever been in the past. We live in the reality that the infrastructure that we're building is becoming so complex that we can't actually keep track of it in our own heads anymore. And some of the systems that we're even building and working on today are becoming so critical that people's lives are even depending upon them. Because of the nature of this mission-critical systems and the infrastructure, incidents are noticed by a lot of people. And these incidents can cost the business a lot in terms of revenue, in terms of brand reputation, loss of productivity, and as mentioned before, in some very extreme cases that are becoming more and more common in our industry, even the loss of people's lives. So, mistakes are becoming a lot more expensive and with greater consequences than they have in the last 10 years. And the impact of even the rarest accident can be so severe that great lengths need to be taken to try and avoid it at all cost. One of the challenges that we have is that we have a lot of these guys who are in charge of these complex systems. Humans are not very reliable. We make a lot of mistakes. Humans also tend to assess themselves as being stronger and better than they are. And this sets up an environment where having those people in charge of the very complex networks without any tools to assist them create an environment where incidents can happen and cost the company quite a lot in terms of revenue, reputation, and loss of productivity. So, total cost of ownership. When we build out our systems, we look at several things to calculate the total cost of ownership. We've generally done this as a combination of capital expenditure. I'm gonna need some servers, I'm gonna need some load balancers, we're gonna lay out a big capital expenditure to buy all of that stuff, plus operational expenditure. What do I need to keep this stuff going month after month? I need some ISP, some hosting, I need power, I need all of that good stuff. And that generally, for the most part, equals total cost of ownership. But the costs of incidents are quantifiable. We can figure out what an hour of downtime is costing your company. And that needs to be taken into consideration for the total cost of ownership of your product, of your service, of your system. So total cost of ownership really becomes capital expenditure plus operational expenditure plus incident expenditure. We can do our best to negotiate with our suppliers and try and get some really good deals. And if we're lucky, maybe we're big and we can leverage our scale and say, you know, we're going to buy our entire year's worth of servers, you know, right now and give us a better deal. We can do the same with our suppliers to a certain extent. But really, our ability to affect CapEx and OpEx is somewhat limited. The most impactful area where we can lower our total cost of ownership of our systems, however, is in incident expenditure. That is an area where we do have a lot of control. So a great way to look at this, and a great way to look at reducing incident cost, is looking at our systems and comparing them to, say, our bodies. Because, you know, our bodies are also very complex systems. If you're relatively fit and healthy, and if you're actively working to keep yourself that way, then really the total cost of ownership over your body is relatively low. When you start to get sick, when you start to require surgical procedures, when you start to get onto prescription medication, and you start to rely on the healthcare systems that we have in our countries, the total cost of ownership over your body rises. Put it really simply, healthy networks are cheaper networks. Well, unhealthy networks cost a lot of money and are very expensive to maintain. So, for every company we've been able to create a checklist culture in, there are many, many more that have failed. The use of checklists can and very often are implemented horribly. So, before we can reach that promised land of checklist nirvana, we have often have to go along a very painful journey. I'm going to speak from my experience, and it's important to say that, of course, my experience isn't going to be the same as yours. To give a little bit of a background, I've spent most of my time in the startup and growth phase of companies. I'm generally in around employee number 30, and I'm usually looking for a new opportunity about 5 years later when the company's at around the 150-person stage. My current company that I'm working for, at about 350 people, is the biggest company I've worked for. So some of what I'm going to say might not apply to you if all you've ever known are really, really large companies that have had all of this put in place when you showed up on day one. But I think that a lot of what I'm going to say is going to resonate with you speak to you. So, to achieve So, let's set our stage. So humans suck. Well, maybe we don't suck, but we do tend to make a lot of mistakes. And mistakes cost the business a lot of money and make the business sad. It also causes the fiery gaze of Sauron's eye to snap upon us and focus all of the attention onto the systems administration team or the operations team or whatever we're going to call ourselves this week. We don't generally like that. We like to be left alone. But because too often we only get noticed by our mistakes, we end up in a situation where the CEO isn't coming into our office saying, "Wow, guys, great uptime over the last couple of months." They only notice the downtime. And a few kind of stories to illustrate my point. There was a squeaky young sysadmin, new and still had that new sysadmin smell, And he was starting into his first real non-tech support sysadmin job. And he was working in an environment that had both Solaris and Linux in it. This was when Linux was still very brand new. And he went to the senior sysadmin and said, on our Linux boxes, we're using this bash. And on the Solaris boxes, we're using C shell when we become root. And you know, the experience is kind of different. Is there any reason why we can't just go change the shell on all of the Solaris boxes for root to bash? And the old senior sysadmin stroked his long beard and thought for a minute and went, yeah, okay, we can do that. Go ahead and make it so. And the young sysadmin did. And the young sysadmin typoed the path to bash. And the young sysadmin also cut and pasted. So he typoed the path to bash on all of the servers, locking everybody out of the production dev and test Solaris boxes, requiring a maintenance window to reboot into rescue mode to fix the path. That young sysadmin learned a little while later that mistakes are not limited to the young. The old senior sysadmin one day accidentally took an out-of-band modem, because that's how we had to access our consoles back in the before time, and left it dialed in from Canada to our server in Venezuela for 3 weeks before anyone noticed. It was only when we got the over $3,000 phone bill that we noticed that the modem had been left dialed into the server, and we had a very, very unhappy director. As the young sysadmin became a more senior sysadmin, mistakes continued to happen, both with him and around him, like the one release engineer who on more than one occasion had to come to our young sysadmin and ask him to restore the company SVN repository from backup because he had deleted the server copy and not his local copy. So, we've made some mistakes. Naturally, we become afraid. We honestly want to do a good job, but we screwed up. And mistakes are getting more and more noticed, and the more that they're getting noticed, the higher the pressure is to be perfect. And the more worry is that, you know, someone's going to walk in and say, oh, you guys screwed up, you're fired. So true story, I got lectured once for making a spelling mistake in a comment in a config file, because if that had not been a comment, it would have caused the config file to bork, and the service wouldn't have started, and doom and gloom and bad things would have happened. So we just made some mistakes. We just cost the company a bunch of money, and we're all afraid. So at this point in time, it's kind of natural, unfortunately, to kind of try and engage in a little bit of company politics, to kind of load balance the responsibility, better known as passing the buck, and you know, in so try and load balance the wrath. And while it would be a lot better for people to just kind of own their mistakes and go the personal responsibility route, fear is an incredibly powerful motivator, and is often not the route that people choose to take. What did those three examples have in common? I think it's pretty clear. They were all mistakes that were absolutely avoidable. They were all mistakes that included human error. You know, not noticing that you typoed bash when you pasted it into over a dozen servers' Etsy password file. Not noticing that you failed to disconnect your modem when you were done or have a timeout in your config. And deleting the repository on the server, not recognizing the fact that you were not on your local laptop. All avoidable, all mistakes that involved human error. But worse, dun dun dun, they all prompted very heavy-handed, top-down, reactionary responses. That fiery, burning eye of Sauron snapped onto the sysadmin team, the lights turned on in our black lair of sysadmindom, and a whole bunch of people in suits came in who had zero clue what we actually do and started looking at every single thing we did over the last year. And when they did, they gave us that look. You know the one. Yeah, that's the one. As far as they're concerned, we're basically holding things together with duct tape and Mountain Dew. And then they raise their fists to the air, and they let loose their war cry. As an aside, I am actually ITIL certified. Like I said, this has been a transformative journey. But I digress. Like the Ten Commandments, we get handed down a new list of rules, processes, procedures, and checklists that we have to follow. We're told that they're not optional, and we're told that it will fix everything. So this immediately sets up our poor friend, the checklist, to be viewed as punishment. Because, let's face it, in this case, that's exactly what it is. We're given these checklists and told, make them work. So it's only natural that we tend to react a bit negatively when this is our first introduction to the friend, our friend, the checklist. Denial. We don't need any checklists. Let's face it. Like I said before, in our world, a lot of the rest of the company looks at us as a big black box. They're not quite sure what we do or how we do it. They just know that stuff comes into our team and then results come out and everything works. And let's face it, oftentimes that's how we like it. So here we are, going from being these free-range sysadmin rock stars, these mysterious people who sit in that one part of the office that you're not quite sure what they do, but they make everything work, and we're being smacked with these checklists. And it's a lot like being sent back to high school with a pocket protector, a cello, and a reverse Polish notation calculator. Well, let's just get one thing straight. Right, so back to denial. One of the challenges we have in this industry is that we have a tendency to romanticize the notion of the cowboy sysadmin. The interwebs are wild, wild west, and we are the only ones brave enough to strap on the cowboy hat and bring law and order to the chaos. We tell old war stories about when everything blew up and the ensuing acts of sysadmin heroism that it took to fix them. A lot of times, we're rewarded for putting out the fires and not building the fireproof house. Well, except there was this one guy about 10 years ago here at LISA who got a sysadmin award for running back into his burning building to pull his tape library. That guy wasn't rewarded for putting out the fire. The point is that we often reward negative behavior while at the same time completely ignoring and failing to acknowledge that it's us in the first place who generally created the climate for which these errors were allowed to happen. This might be me, but I think this almost incentivizes us to do bad things and to not fix things. And it reinforces the denial for the need for tools like checklists to help us be better people. Checklists are used by some of the smartest people in the world. And they're relied heavily in industries such as healthcare, aviation, and construction. We have a reasonable expectation that the room we're sitting in right now is not going to collapse on us. We have a reasonable expectation that the plane we're going to get on, either tonight or tomorrow or whenever we're heading home, is going to get us home. And we have a reasonable expectation, although there are cases, that if we go in for a surgical procedure, they're not going to leave a wristwatch or anything strange inside of us. But it wasn't always even the case. You know, they don't let a surgeon cut into people and they don't let a pilot fly a plane without using checklists these days. And our pilots and surgeons are not the stupidest people we have. They've embraced the checklist as a way of reducing human error. But that wasn't the case at the beginning. When they were first working to implement the World Health Organization's Safe Surgery Checklist, that's a lot of words, a group of surgeons who basically said, you know, we don't think the checklists are going to have any impact, were asked, if you had to go in tomorrow for a complicated surgical procedure, would you like the surgery team that was going to follow the World Health Organization checklist? Or would you like the surgery team that was just going to rely on their memory and skill? And every one of those surgeons who said that checklists wouldn't make a big deal went with the team that was going to follow the checklist. And I think we would find the same thing in our industry. If you were to hand a sysadmin $1 million and say, you can pick team A, who's going to follow a checklist, or team B, who's not, for your complicated upgrade, And if there's a mistake, I'm going to take that $1 million back from you. I think a lot of people would choose the team that would follow the checklist as well to help reduce their chance of risk. After denial, we come to anger. To go back a few slides to fear, personal responsibility is hard. So rather than accepting that we make mistakes and we need help, we tend to get angry about things, especially as a counter-reaction to that initial punishment of having to use checklists in the first place. We become angry at that guy, you know, the one who caused the incident in the first place that set in motion all of the corporate Rube Goldberg machine that brought us to where we are now with having to use checklists and processes and change control. Doesn't matter how many errors there were in the past, it's all that guy's fault. In a display of some of the worst that human behavior has to offer, we turn on that person, we ostracize them, we put them down so that we can prop ourselves up with the illusion that I'm not the problem, it's that guy, I don't need the checklist, he does. Rather than becoming humble and embracing the notion that we need help, we become arrogant. I have root. I can do what I want, as long as I don't screw up things, which I won't, because I'm not that guy and I'm awesome, then everything will be fine. Needless to say, the relationship between management and the people in the trenches become cold and distant. Heck, this is even the point where some people bail. I've seen it many times over. You start putting in processes, checklists, change control, and the like, and people start saying things like, oh, this company is getting too big. I don't want to deal with all this red tape. I'm going to go work for a smaller company where I don't have to deal with all this crap. The problem is that when checklists are forced upon people, we tend to feel like Big Brother is watching us, that we've had the handcuffs slapped on and not in the woo-hoo way. We feel like we have the training wheels put back on the bike, but most of all, we feel like we're not trusted. So I used to work for a company which was involved in electronic land transfer, basically the buying and selling of houses. In Canada, and I don't know how it is here in the United States, houses are actually bought and sold by lawyers. It's not the real estate agents, it's not anyone else. It's only the lawyers who can actually do that transaction to sell a house from one person to another person. It's a legal transaction. And so I worked for a company who is trying to make this electronic. Before, they would have to get down to the land title office in person. They would have to fill out all sorts of paperwork. It took a lot of time to buy and sell a house. And so we would have this, you know, this piece of software that would allow the lawyers to do it online. And as one might think, when it comes to being able to buy and sell houses, this software had a bunch of security around it. You had your username and password, but it also had an encrypted key on a 3.5-inch floppy disk, back in those days where we had those, that needed to be in the drive or else nothing worked. So of course this two-factor auth was the bane of the existence of both tech support and the lawyers. Always seemed to be screwing up. And lawyers, who are also very smart people, can become very, very angry and defensive when they feel like they're stupid, when they would have to call into tech support and have to kind of lower themselves down to the layer of the tech support person that oftentimes they didn't feel very highly about because that was the person who could fix their problem. And I've seen this a lot with sysadmins as well. When sysadmins, who are also generally smart people, are made to feel stupid, we, in many cases, also become very defensive and angry. Wait a second, Chris. What did you just say there? We are very smart people. We don't need any checklists. We can fix this thing. Okay, so just hear me out. We don't need this whole checklist thing. All we need to do is add more monitoring checks. We'll put in checks for whatever it was that blew up and that we forgot to do, and then we don't need the checklist. So while it's true that incidents often will bring up the need to add monitoring, the problem there is that it really only tells you that you have made a mistake. It doesn't really actually help you from preventing a mistake in the first place. Okay, Well, then we'll do the config management. We'll put everything into config management, and then we don't need checklists. You said to yourself, humans suck at doing repetitive tasks. Computers are great at that stuff. Problem solved. Well, configuration management can solve a lot of problems, and it's personally one of my areas of expertise. I've been using it pretty religiously since about 2005. If it's done right, it's a very powerful tool and it can reduce the chance of human error. But just like anything else, if it's not architected and implemented and built properly, if you kind of implement it in a knee-jerk reaction to mistakes and problems like this, you actually introduce the possibility of increasing the risk of even more human error and even more risk into your infrastructure. As well, you still have to manage changes to your templates, to your modules, to your cookbooks, to your whatnot, and the risk of human error shifts from the box to the operator, which can still be reduced by having them use something like a checklist but while they're mucking around in your config management repo. It's unfortunate, but really by the time you hit the bargaining stage, the time for bargaining is long past. So depression sets in, we become gloomy, we dress in even more black, and Taylor Swift songs start to make sense. It's a really rough time. So our culture has changed. It's undeniable, and we fear change. The excitement is gone. We spend a lot more time thinking about and writing checklists about what we're going to do than actually doing it. Our work is on display for all to see, to be scrutinized and to be questioned. But I'm root. You don't question me. We've hit bottom, and we're forced to look inwards and to understand the following truths. We are not as good as we think we are. We make mistakes, but we want to be better, and we want to do a good job. So we give it a try. As you start to accept the power of checklists into your life, you begin to see some more positives. Those upgrade from hells that took hours and hours and hours start to become a lot smoother. They start to become a lot more routine, and they start to be finishing up within the windows that you said they were going to finish up in. You start to find yourself with more time to do things during the day and work on awesome projects than fighting the fires. You find that you can, in theory, end your workday on time because nothing is blowing up at 4:30 in the afternoon, causing you to have to work late, in theory. Your on-call rotation becomes more bearable. You're up less frequently at 3 in the morning. Ideally, you begin to get praise and recognition for bringing stability and reliability to your service. At the very least, the fiery eye of Sauron moves on to a different part of the business. There tends to be a slightly higher tolerance for when incidents happen, because you can easily show that precautions were taken and that checklists were followed. And you lower that all-important incident expenditure, which gives your company more money for salaries, bonuses, conferences, Nerf guns, etc. But of critical importance, faith is restored. So, that was some fun stories, but what did we actually learn? Well, we learned oftentimes checklists are implemented very badly. They can both be used and viewed as punishment. They have the power to make really smart people feel dumb. They force us to acknowledge that we make mistakes and that we are not as awesome as we think we are. They are not glamorous. You're never going to hear people talking around the water cooler about the amazing checklist that Joe made yesterday. And if they're not implemented correctly, it can be a very, very long road to acceptance, and oftentimes you're not even going to get there. So it's no wonder that we have such a hard time getting people to embrace checklists, even when most people agree that they would make our lives better. So, did anyone also notice that our journey for rejecting and accepting the checklist was in itself a checklist, the 5 stages of grief? I know, Meta. So let's take a quick look at my current company. I won't say that we're doing everything perfect, but I think that we've done a lot of things to allow us to be successful when it comes to implementing checklists. So I work for Pythian. We provide sysadmin and DBA consulting services to companies where their data is mission critical. I'm a manager in the site reliability engineering practice of our company, and I lead a team of consultants from around the world, and we have a 24/7 follow the sun model. Our ability to reduce occurrences of human error is one of our market differentiators and critical to our success of business. You're paying us, you don't want us to be the ones making mistakes on the servers. We're kind of looked at to be the gold standard of what sysadmins should be doing when they are logging on to boxes. You know, at any given time, one of my consultants can be on one of our clients' networks, and there is a very high demand for us to not be the ones who are creating the incidents. So to reduce our occurrences of human error, we needed to transform the culture of the company from the top down. Our CEO, Paul Vallée, led the charge and made it clear that when it came to using checklists, this was something that all levels of our company needed to do, not just the guys in the trenches. In fact, Paul, who's a very, very enthusiastic person, has a sticker on the enter key of his keyboard in our office that says FitAcer, which is the name of our checklist, that reminds him to run it before he hits enter. And I just can't make this stuff up, guys. That is really how important our checklist is in our company. So we also, in order to create a culture that accepted checklists, we had to create a culture that acknowledged that mistakes happen and that everyone in the company is, from the smartest person down, makes mistakes. We implemented a culture of the blameless postmortem and encouraged people to be open and honest about the mistakes that they had made with full disclosure so that we could learn from them and allow people to take responsibility and own their mistakes and give a chance for them to say what they were going to do to fix it and what they were going to do to allow it to, or to not allow it to happen again, rather. So in order to make all of this happen, we needed to learn a thing or two about checklists and how people think. So if you build it, they will come. But if you build it and it's 10 pages long, they will leave. The first key to building a great checklist is that it needs to be short. Studies have been done, and they recommend keeping a checklist to about 7 or 8 points. But Chris, you say, my incredibly complicated upgrade can't be distilled down into 7 or 8 points. And I agree. But chances are you can split your upgrade into smaller sections that can be distilled into smaller checklists. So we need to remember that checklists are not an excuse for self-lobotomy. Attention, engagement, and creativity matter, but we need to shift that creativity into the creation of the checklist and not into improvising at upgrade time. Also, our knowledge and experience matter. We can't follow checklists blindly. Doing so means that we completely failed to deeply understand why we have the checklist there in the first place. They're there to enhance our ability to be proactive, creative, and help reduce error, not so we can check our brains at the door when we come to work. Let's talk about how we think really quickly. Those who have studied this have come up with a theory about two different systems of thinking. If I ask you guys what 2+2 is or who the President of the United States of America is, chances are those answers likely and hopefully arrived automatically and without effort. In fact, there was almost nothing you could do to stop those answers from popping into your head. This is called System 1 thinking. Some defining characteristics of this thinking are that it's unconscious, automatic, effortless, and without a self-awareness or control. System 1 thinking is really what you see is really all there is. In counterpoint to that, if I asked you guys, what's 367 times 482, unless you're a math whiz, chances are that took you a bit of time and energy to calculate. The answer, of course, is 176,894, if anyone's wondering. This slower analytical thinking is called System 2 thinking. It's defined by being deliberate and conscious, effortful, a controlled mental process with self-awareness and control, and is both logical and skeptical. So there's a pretty easy argument to be made that technology has outpaced evolution. What's important here is to know that System 1 type of thinking is the same type of quick thinking that's linked to our flight and fight reflex. And while that's really good to help us keep out of harm's way, it's not the type of thinking we necessarily want in play when we are in a stressful, complicated infrastructure problem. System 1 thinking is the type of thinking we go to by default when things go wrong and when we get stressed. But Chris, we can train System 2 into becoming System 1 type thinking. Yes, you can. Let's take riding a bike for an example. At first, riding a bike is a very complicated process. You need to deal with balance, with pedaling and steering and braking and watching where you're going and making sure you're not going to run into anything, and then you have to be able to turn. And lots going on, but the more and more you ride a bike, the more and more those actions become automatic. And while we can do this to a certain degree with our jobs, if we're really doing what we say we're doing, and that is addressing repeatable incidents, hopefully when that monitoring system goes off, we're dealing with a situation we haven't seen before. We're dealing with something that's novel, and we're dealing with something where System 1 thinking will not be the most useful type of thinking. So in any average day in your company, you know, you're sitting around, you're working on some cool project, when all of a sudden the monitoring system goes off, a knock guy comes running out with his hands flailing in the air going, "Oh my God, what are we gonna do?" You reach over, you grab the cowboy hat, you put it on. You don't know what the problem is or how you're gonna solve it, but this is your time to shine. Let's do this. Alternatively, it's an average day at your company. You're sitting around working on something awesome. All of a sudden, the monitoring systems come on. The guy runs out of the knock with his arms flailing, going, "Oh my God, what are we going to do?" You click on the alert in your monitoring system. It takes you to your wiki, a description of what the alert means, and a quick checklist on what to try to resolve that alert. Both of these scenarios are absolutely real, especially the knock guy coming out and flailing his arms going, "Oh my God, what are we gonna do?" But what these both illustrate are habits. And I'm not gonna say whether they're good habits or bad habits. They are habits, and they're generally old habits, and those are the hardest habits to change. When you start to use a checklist, though, you start to put into place a new habit, a habit of how you're going to act and how you're gonna work when you're on a server. And this becomes a keystone habit which causes a cascade of change with everything you do and every way that you think about how you're going to act when you're working on a server. And you move from being a cowboy to being an engineer. So the checklist we use at our company is called FitAcer. FitAcer was created by our company's founder, Paul Vallée, and it's open sourced under the Creative Commons license, so everyone is free to use it and modify it to their needs. FitAcer is not about knowing how to do the work on the server. What FitAcer does is it addresses some of the foundational habits of how you're going to act when you are on a server. It focuses on that to create a keystone habit around responsible ownership of the work you're doing when you're on box. And one of the great things about FitAcer is that it's a really quick and easy checklist to use, because most of the things on that checklist are something you would, well, or at least should be doing in the first place. So FitAcer stands for Focus, Identify, Type, Access, Check, Execute, and Review. So focus, we're gonna slow down. Are you in the right mind frame to do that work? Everyone has had that day where they're like, "I should not be root. I should not be on a server with root. I'm not safe to do this work." Under our model, you hand that off. You acknowledge that I might be having a bad day. Today's not a good day for me to do something complicated as root. I'm gonna go work on some documentation or one of those rainy day lists where we have some easier tasks. I need someone else to help me. You limit the distractions, including holding your pager and taking phone calls. The last thing you need to do when you're in the middle of a change is to get paged. The last thing you need to have in the middle of a big change is to have a phone call come in. You hand that stuff off. You work in a quiet area, free of noise and distractions, and you avoid having multiple windows open if possible. Next, we're going to identify the server, the database, whatever we're working on, and we're going to do that every time we get distracted. Because if we don't, we're going to drop the wrong database in the wrong environment, or we're going to RM the wrong thing on the wrong place. We're going to check the server name, make sure that it's the right box. We're going to do this every time we're distracted. We're going to make sure we're authorized to do the work and that we have all of our necessary approvals. And if we do have to have multiple windows open, we're going to try and do something to make sure we identify them. We're going to change the background color. We're going to do something like that, change the prompt. So we're also going to check the time in the time zone. This is a very Pythian thing. We're 24/7. Our clients come in. They say, we want you to upgrade this thing at 6 a.m. And we're like, OK. So is that 6 a.m. GMT, Eastern time, Pacific time? We've had challenges where we've done upgrades where we've had some cross-communications, one of the reasons why FitAcer came into place in the first place. So next, we're going to type the command, drama. But we're not going to hit enter yet. We're going to assess the command. Is that command actually going to do what we want it to do? We're going to consult a peer. We're going to tab out. We're going to look at the Google. We're going to look at man pages and other tools. We're going to make sure that the command is going to do what we want it to do, or the script is going to do what we want the script to do. We're going to go back to the box. We're going to check again, because we've gone to a different window. We've maybe gone over to a person's desk. We want to make sure, again, we're not going to drop the wrong database. We're not going to run the script on the wrong box. So then we're going to execute the command, which is basically pressing enter. And then we're going to review the results in document to make sure that pressing enter and running the command actually did what we wanted to do. Again, everything here with FitAcer is mostly common sense. It would be stuff that we would do anyways. But by turning it into a checklist and making it something we do consciously every time we access people's servers, it forces us to slow down. It forces us to switch from system one to system two thinking, and it allows us to make sure that what we're doing so with knowledge of what we're about to do and not just running on autopilot. So does it really work? Well, for us, absolutely yes. So as I mentioned before, we have an incident review process where we track what we call FitAcer incidents, or incidents that have been caused by human error. And over the course of the years, we've been able to drive our incident caused by human error rate down to one incident for every 6.5 years of service that we've delivered to our clients. So in conclusion, as with many of the systems that we design and build, checklists can be implemented in a very successful way, but often times are implemented in a way that doesn't set them up to be very successful. The power of the checklist as a tool for reducing our chances of human error is pretty much accepted. But getting it accepted into our culture and into our community is still a challenge that we're facing every day. But it's a challenge that we have to take up because our data is becoming more critical. And as our industries moves to the point where what we're doing is having a much more impact upon people's lives, we have to ensure that we take every step to reduce human error and deliver our services with as much reliability as we can. Thank you very much.